makes great programs possible, and fights hunger in our community.
All right. Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, January 24th, 2010, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. The original sin of the United States, of course, it's racial history, and its racial history remains alive and well in the year 2010. Today we're going to be talking to the author of an extraordinarily provocative book on what's going on with race in America and whiteness. Our author, Rich Benjamin, will be joining us. We'll be talking about his new book, Searching for Whitetopia. Should be a terrific hour, so I hope you'll join us today. But before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. In a surge of last-minute activity, more than 19,000 comments, representing several hundred thousand individuals and hundreds of groups, were filed at the Federal Communications Commission last week prior to the deadline for initial comments on new network neutrality rules. Misty Perez-Trutzen is program manager of Free Press and the SaveTheInternet.com Coalition, an alliance of hundreds of groups dedicated to preserving net neutrality, the long-standing principle that prevents big phone and cable companies from discriminating against online content or applications.
The FCC received close to 200,000 comments, which is actually quite an amazing amount of comments in the docket. And a good, I would say the majority of those are from the public and their comments in favor of net neutrality rules, strong net neutrality protections. And so some of the most interesting comments that were in there were filed from individuals like you or I that were just going to the docket and inputting our thoughts on why an open internet is important to us, maybe important to us as a small business owner, a gamer, somebody who simply just likes to communicate with their friends and family online.
Comments were filed by a wide array of individuals, including engineers, musicians, scientists, artists, organizers, small businesses, residents of rural communities, and venture capitalists, to name a few. Perez-Trutzen believes it's incredibly important for the public to engage in a process like this one and share personal stories with policymakers.
I think so many people did it because they care about the open internet. They recognize that the internet is the future of our communication system and we need to protect it. I think it's very easy when you explain to somebody what net neutrality is for them to grasp that, yeah, that's what I want for my internet experience. I want it to be open. I want to be able to access the websites and communicate with the folks that I care about and do what I want on the internet without having a gatekeeper.
To find out more about net neutrality, visit SaveTheInternet.com.
What kind of media behemoth would arise from the merger of Comcast and NBC Universal? In an open letter to President Obama and Congress, a group of industry, labor, and public interest organizations described a destructive giant that would harm smaller competitors and drive up prices for consumers. The organizations that signed the letter don't always see eye to eye, but groups like Common Cause and the Parents Television Council agree with the Writers Guild of America and Morality in Media that the merger will damage the media landscape and diminish diverse voices on TV. The American Cable Association also signed on to the letter. It represents nearly 900 small and rural cable companies across the country. Vice President Ross Lieberman says that Comcast and NBC currently compete to provide programming to cable companies. If the merger happens, much of that competition will disappear.
The fact that the USA Network won't be competing with E! Entertainment Network for programming and aren't competing to get eyeballs from our customers, they'll be able to join together and they'll be offered at the same time, and you won't have that competition that many times drives those costs lower.
And with increasing costs, the smaller cable providers aren't able to reinvest in their networks.
What ends up happening is they've left money left over to make investments, to upgrade their services, to roll out broadband deeper into their service areas, to further deploy the competitive telephone services, and in the worst case, pushes them out of business.
David Goodfriend, a satellite industry lobbyist and radio host, is concerned about Comcast's past behavior regarding sports programming. He's started SportsFansCoalition.org, an alliance of groups concerned about access to sports on TV.
One of the most glaring examples of the sports media marketplace breaking down is in cities like Philadelphia, San Diego, New York, where the cable company also owns the local sports team and the local sports arena and the local sports network, and lo and behold tells you that the only way you can watch your local team is if you subscribe to cable, no other way. So we ask a logical question. If that's how Comcast plays in its own backyard, what happens when it owns NBC Sports?
Goodfriend wants sports fans to understand media issues and have a voice in public policy matters in Washington.
Sports are like the canary in the coal mine. Everybody understands sports, enjoys sports, but when you find yourself less and less able to watch your favorite teams, that's an indicator of the media marketplace falling apart.
Comcast will be filing pre-merger papers with the Federal Communications Commission and the Department of Justice by the end of the month. Both the House and the Senate plan to hold hearings on the merger in the near future. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is Rich Benjamin, the author of a new book, Searching for Whitetopia, an improbable journey to the heart of white America, just published in the last few months by Hyperion Books to considerable acclaim. Rich Benjamin works for Demos, a think tank where he's a senior fellow based out of New York City, and is a PhD from Stanford in modern thought and literature, and a BA in political science from Wesleyan. Rich Benjamin, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob. Glad to be here.
Well, I very much enjoyed your book, and one of the interesting things about your book, Rich, as I read it, was that you sort of reveal more and more about yourself gradually through the book, going right up to the final and penultimate paragraphs of the book. And I think maybe I'd like to switch things around for our discussion today and start with maybe a little of your own biography and history before we discuss much of the book, because I think it sheds a lot of light on the perspectives you bring to the book.
Sure.
So if you just give a little bit of the Rich Benjamin story, that would be great.
As you mentioned, I work at a think tank called Demos, and we're devoted to improving our nation's economy and improving the quality of our democracy here in America. One biographical detail I should mention is that I'm black. Your radio listeners may not know that. And I say that because it's very relevant to the 27,000-mile journey I took. For example, if one were to review golf clubs for a sports magazine, one couldn't do so and fail to mention the fact that one is left-handed. Left-handed is very relevant to how you review golf clubs, just like being black is very relevant to how you review white America. So that's another important biographical detail. And I guess the third one I might mention is that I grew up in a very white suburb that was at least very white when I was growing up, and it's Montgomery County, Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C., and that's where I grew up. And so that sort of inspired my fascination and understanding of Whitetopia, although I should also mention that I am a native New Yorker. I was actually born in New York City, where I presently live.
And your parents came to the United States from Africa, if I understood your biography correctly?
Not my parents. My father had, yes.
Your father had, okay.
Yeah.
And so, Rich, before we get into your book, I did see a couple columns you've written recently about Martin Luther King Day. And since Martin Luther King Day was this last Monday, it's a national holiday. I was just wondering if there were parts of Martin Luther King's history that have been lost in sort of his creation of a holiday and the celebration of him. What about the Martin Luther King's actual history do you think is most important for Americans today and going forward? What should we learn from him?
I think that we should learn to keep his history relevant. Martin Luther King fought doggedly for class-related issues, what he called economic justice. And Martin Luther King was assassinated as he was marching with garbage workers, unionized garbage workers in Memphis. So that's one element of his legacy that we should keep in mind. And the problem with Martin Luther King's relevancy is that on the left, liberals tend to distort it and make it into this teddy bear, sweet, saccharine, kumbaya legacy that has no actual bearing to what he actually fought for. And on the right, conservatives tend to distort his call that we take in, that we be taken for the content of our character as a statement that we ignore racial inequality. And so they make this rhetorical slip that says, oh, Martin Luther King said, take me for the content of my character, but that doesn't mean King fought that we ignore racial inequality.
I have a friend who teaches African-American history. He's white American, but he teaches African-American history, and he tells the story of his young son, who was, I think, 8 years old at the time, who came home from elementary school a few years ago, the day after Martin Luther King Day, and was very confused by the discussion of the holiday in his school. And he said to his dad, Daddy, was Martin Luther King black? Because it's just completely sanitized out of the picture. Our guest, Rich Benjamin, the new book, which we're going to be talking about, Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. Rich, let's get right to it. Why did you want to write this book, and what is Whitetopia?
Well, I'll describe Whitetopia first. Whitetopia are idealized communities across our country that hark back to the 1950s. And to my mind, a Whitetopia has three traits. The first is that it has grown by more than 6% since the year 2000. The second is the majority of that growth comes from white migrants, upwards of 90%. And the third trait is harder to define, but no less important, and that is a Whitetopia has an ineffable charm, a pleasant look and feel. And so there are many Whitetopias in America. I list them all in the book. And so I just launched a journey and lived in three of them just to see what I would find.
Indeed, you do. And what did you hope to find? And what was the point of going to Whitetopias as opposed to mixed neighborhoods or Blacktopias or inner city neighborhoods?
The point was that, A, I don't feel like enough intelligent things have been written about the future of white America. But a critical point is a fact that has been really haunting the press, and that is by 2042, white people will no longer be the majority in America. So if white people's cultural, political, and numeric status is declining, what does it mean for our country's future, and what are exclusively white enclaves like?
You say it's haunting the press. I think that's interesting. In what way is the emerging minority status of white people in the United States haunting the media in the United States?
Well, especially the conservative media, the conservative corporate media. So you'll have Patrick Buchanan on Fox News saying, what is happening to white America is what has happened to black people and Native Americans. We are a besieged minority. Another example is John Gibson on Fox News explains to his majority white viewers that 40% of kids under the age of 5 are minorities. So he tells his viewers, do your duty, make more babies. So
I guess he knows his demographics of his audience.
Pardon me?
I guess he knows the demographics of his audience.
I guess
he's
so.
Imploring them to reproduce.
You know? Yeah. And so that's what I mean by haunting the press. But we also see it in the corporate liberal press. It's getting a lot of coverage that by 2042, white people will no longer be the American majority.
Our guest, Rich Benjamin, the author of the brand new book, Searching for Whytopia. We'll take calls or questions here at Media Matters for our guest. The number at WILLAM 580-333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Rich, it's a fascinating journey. I didn't realize I thought your PhD was in anthropology, by the way you wrote it, as an ethnography. And, why did you pick you spent several months in three distinct Whytopian communities, Utah, Idaho, and Georgia. Why did you pick those three? What were your criteria?
Those three are the most rich and representative. St. George, because it's in the growing Southwest, and the Southwest is the fastest growing region in America. I chose Idaho because it's on the Rocky Mountain Plains, and the West is the second fastest growing region in America. And I chose Forsyth County, Georgia, because it's an exurb. I really wanted to take a sustained peek at this exurb phenomenon. So each of those three places represents something of larger Whytopias.
Before we get into each of them in detail, and I want to start as you go, I'm going to go in the same order you do in the book and start it with Utah. You just use the term exurb, which appears a great deal in the book.
Mm-hmm.
What is an exurb, and what's the difference between an exurb and a Whytopia?
Okay. An exurb is the area around an outer suburb. So if you imagine concentric rings, in the center of the ring, you would have a city, then you would have an inner suburb, then you would have an outer suburb, and further still, you would have an exurb. Now, most exurbs in America are overwhelmingly white. By that I mean they are more than 85% white. However, not every exurb is a Whytopia, A, because not every exurb is growing quickly, and B, you do have a few exurbs that are as diverse as the rest of the country. So they're not conflatable terms.
Although there is considerable overlap between the two.
Yes.
Well, let's start, dive right into the first place you went. And, you went to St. George's, Utah. At least it's the first in the book. I don't know if you actually went there first of the three, if you just decided to put it first in the book. But when you went to a community like this, what did you do to learn about it? What was your modus operandi when you went to a place like St. George's, Utah, so you could learn about it?
What are my travel secrets?
Exactly. Well, tell us what you did.
First and foremost, I have to live in the community. So there are no hotels. There are no crashing at friends. I live in the community. I rent a house in the community. And to me, that is critical. Another thing I do is I read the local press and the local papers, and I figure out what those important papers are. Another thing is I golfed. I spent a lot of time in country clubs, and I learned to play golf. And so golf is a perfect seductive emblem of Whytopia, and so I didn't figure I could understand Whytopia without spending time on golf courses.
How's your game, by the way?
Well, it's improved markedly, but it's still pretty bad.
I know that I'm not a country club guy by nature, but I know in the past country clubs were restricted to ethnic minorities oftentimes. Is that an issue at these country clubs in Whytopia?
Well, there are not a lot of ethnic minorities, period. I mean, I would go weeks on end without seeing another person of color in or off the golf course. So, no, I did not see minorities on the golf course. However, that's not the golf course's fault. It's not like I saw minorities in church either.
And then what would you tell folks? You just started telling them you're just in the neighborhood hanging out?
No, I told them I was writing a book about the growth of their community and the political and cultural and social flavor of their community. And I did other things. I went to meetings of the Republican County Organization. I went to the county tax planning meetings. I went to a lot of civic-minded meetings. I socialized a lot. I played a lot of poker. I fell in with a poker crew. And so we'd play Texas Hold'em with a $10 buy-in. It was a lot of socializing. I had people over to my house for dinner. I like to entertain myself. And so I'd have people over for dinner parties, and in turn, they'd invite me for dinner parties. So, I mean, that's how I felt I got the spirit and essence of a place. is to throw myself face first, headlong, into the social and political buzz of the community.
When I read the book, and especially when I read your other writings that I'm familiar with, Rich, it's clear you have, I would say, fairly liberal politics or progressive politics. When political issues came up, when you were in Utah and Idaho and Georgia and in various Whitetopias, were you guarded in your comments not to, to sort of set yourself off as being sort of unusual by the standards of the community and lay low, or did you sort of dive face first into political discussions?
No, I did not have political discussions. I think it's a difference in people's approach. Michael Moore likes to let his politics be known, and for him, research is often confrontation. I take a different approach. My politics is irrelevant. I'm not writing about me on my journey. And so, no, I did not.
And I sense in the book, in all three places, that you actually had a pretty good time. I mean, that you met some people you liked and you enjoyed yourself.
Yes, I think that's true. I think for the most part, I had a really good time.
Were you surprised?
Yes, I was. I was surprised because I'm not a country club person, and I didn't expect to like golf. That's one element of surprise. The other element of surprise is I have a very city background. I've been living in cities most of my life, and so that's another element. I didn't expect to like fishing. And so, yes, I was surprised by what good a time I had socially.
And, you know, in Utah in particular, Rich Benjamin, the issue of immigration seemed to be the big hot button, most important political issue in the community of St. George's. And maybe talk a little bit about the whole question of immigration, Latino workers, service workers. We are the one minority that sort of shows up, at least in that Whitetopia. And also a little bit more background on St. George's, Utah itself, about the nature of that community.
Absolutely. St. George is an hour and a half drive northeast of Las Vegas in the southern corner of Utah, the southwestern corner of Utah. It's a bubbling, pretty community, and immigration, as you mentioned, Bob, is just a hot issue. One of the things I did in that part of my journey was to tag a group called the Citizens Council Against Illegal Immigration, and that gave me a taste of what a hot issue immigration is. So when Joe Wilson stood up in the U.S. Congress and he told the president, "You lie," fearing that health care and his quote-unquote tax dollars would go wasted, quote-unquote, on illegal immigrants, I'd been hearing those sorts of complaints for 2 years. And that was one of the defining issues of St. George, Utah. People there are total examples of white flight. They fled often Southern California, Tucson, and Phoenix because, and they said this to my face, those pockets of America had become overrun with immigrants. And by that, they mean Latino immigrants.
Mm-hmm. And so when you were in these groups, and I was struck by how open and candid the anti-immigration groups were in your presence, and they sort of welcomed you, it seemed, almost as a comrade in arms. What was your sense of their knowledge level and awareness of the issue and sort of engagement with the facts?
Well, I think often it was reality and fact deprived, the discussions they had. So, for example, they would blame terrorism on lax borders. They would claim that immigrants don't pay taxes. In fact, immigrants, no matter what their legal status, do pay taxes. If you buy something, you pay a consumption tax. They claim that all immigrants are here to abuse our social welfare system. So there were a lot. It was oftentimes a fact-challenged community, and that shouldn't surprise anybody. I mean, Joe Wilson's accusations against the president were also fact-challenged.
Did you think, you write about the sort of obsession and really deep concern about immigration, really going far beyond then the sort of factual issues. It sort of struck a chord, right, about white a notion of white America?
It does, but they don't say white America. They say America, which inherently means white. In other words, if you say America and you're invoking a cultural history, a political history, you're implicitly saying white America. One of the most poignant comments I heard throughout Whitetopia, and especially in Utah, was a woman literally told me, who belonged to this St. George Citizen Council Against Illegal Immigration, she said, "Rich, those of us who understand the basic values of America are a dying breed." Mm-hmm. And that was such a racially loaded comment. It's a comment also loaded by generation. She just felt that people who understand the Constitution and our culture and our heritage, as if we had one heritage, are a dying breed. Another poignant comment I often heard was, "We want to take our country back." And that always leaves me to scratch my head and wonder, take it back from what? From mm-hmm. Obama? From what?
Our guest, Rich Benjamin, author of the new book, Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America, just published to considerable acclaim by Hyperion Books. He's joining us live today on Media Matters, WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Rich Benjamin, the number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Rich, throughout the book, you deal not only with issues of race, but of class. They're unavoidable. Many Whitetopias also are very much upper class or upper middle class. I mean, they are expensive places to be, and only a small percentage of Americans could afford to live in some of these Whitetopias. Not all, I mean, but at times you address this issue about the relationship of race and class in America, and it's a recurring theme throughout the book. What did you learn about race and class during this research?
I learned a lot. I just wanted to quickly say I care deeply about class issues and class inequality in America. And you asked me what surprised me before.
Mm-hmm.
Class and the degree to which it's an issue surprised me. And one of the things I'm proudest about in the reception of this book is that Amazon ranks books according to topic, class, race. Race doesn't even have a rank, but people who are concerned about class are reading this book, evidently. But to answer your question, what did I learn about race and class? Well, I learned one thing I learned is that we need to consider how white people gentrify white communities. In my head, I had this idea that hip, wealthy white people move into inner city communities, you know, in Chicago, and they gentrify it. But white people and rich white people can also gentrify white communities to devastating effect of the existing white population. And the class divides, even in Whitetopia, really starkly hit me often. But one time it became particularly apparent. In the early afternoon, I was hanging out with a guy called Ed. And slowly, through our friendship, I learned that he was living out of a rented storage unit because he could not afford an apartment or a home in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Now, that very day, I also went to a meet-and-greet at the luxurious estate of cattle barons, and the guest of honor that afternoon was Republican U.S. Senator Mike Crapo, and he gave this long spiel that America needs more tax relief. And so that's a taste of the sharp class divides, even in homogenous Whitetopia.
And you mentioned Idaho, which is the second journey in your book. And I think Idaho, the area you specifically went up near Hayden Lake in the northern panhandle of Idaho, mm-hmm. arguably some of the most beautiful real estate or country, not only in North America, but in the world. Mm-hmm. It was notorious in the Northwest, at least, and I think nationally, because that was the home of the militant quasi-Nazi white supremacist and voraciously anti-African-American racist groups of the sort of Christian identity movement of the 70s and 80s. Is that one of the reasons you wanted to go up there?
Is it one? No. I can't say that it was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it certainly provides a rich texture and background information once I was there, but I didn't choose it for that reason.
I see. Well, what was it? Was it a different racial environment in Idaho from the White Hopi of Idaho than it was, say, in Utah?
Yes, it was. And Idaho is very different. It's very different than both Utah and Georgia. Now, it's different from Utah because they're not as quote-unquote close to quote-unquote illegal immigration in the way you are in Utah. In other words, the Latino population really hasn't made its way anywhere near Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. So that's really not a hot-button issue. And Idaho is different than Georgia because there's no history of slavery or there's no black middle-class population. I mean, Georgia's a whitetopia that's right against or right near a population popping with black folks with money near Atlanta. In Idaho, you don't have that. Idaho's just white on its own terms.
Mm-hmm. We are, our guest is Rich Benjamin. The number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Call in if you'd like to have any questions or comments for Rich Benjamin, author of the brand-new book we're talking about, Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Marseille, Illinois, you're on the air.
Whoa, interesting conversation you're having. I think Pat Buchanan doesn't go on Fox. I think he's on MSNBC exclusively, which I think is fact. Secondly, have you ever considered, I'm sure that you have, I haven't read your book, the problem of crime in the inner city that led most middle-class white people to vote with their dollars and move, take their dollars out, causing the blight in the inner cities? And I just wonder how that plays into Whitetopia. Just fear of crime, and I'll hang up and let you comment. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And yes, that's a great question, Rich, and I think something you address at some length in the book.
Yes, 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 it does. One of my favorite—I won't give it away—but one of my favorite parts of the book is when I'm mugged in an inner city, and that allows me to do this great riff on crime and what crime has to do with people living cities. And so the caller's question is very well taken. Another thing that the callers mentioned is flight from cities in general. So it's not as though only white people flee crime or white people flee inner cities. There's black flight, too. There's middle-class black flight. Now, white people will tend to flee homogenous neighborhoods, whereas middle-class and upper-middle-class black people and Latino people tend to flee to integrated neighborhoods. So that's one difference. And what the book talks about is perceived safety. And the caller is also talking to the question of class. I mean, not every city is crime-ridden. Crime has been going down sharply in my native New York City for the last 15 years. And so just to say that there are crime in cities and therefore people flee cities is wrong. The crime is concentrated in pockets of poverty, not in cities generally. And so we can't just say, oh, people leave cities because there's crime. That's just not true. People leave cities also because of pluralism. Now, people leave concentrated parts of the inner city that are crime-ridden. That is true.
It does seem when we're talking about Idaho just now, a big part of the book was the huge exodus of Los Angeles police officers from L.A. to Idaho. And it struck me in your comments on them that a lot of them were just had this great dislike of the situation they thought was heavily crime-ridden in Los Angeles and wanted to get somewhere where there was a lot less crime. Is that an accurate way to put it?
Yes.
Including, who's that O.J. guy again? Who's sort of
Mark Furman.
Mark Furman.
I don't think Mark Furman was fleeing crime in L.A. I think he was fleeing the media in L.A., diversity in L.A., or all sorts of personal reasons why he may have left. I mean, I never interviewed him. But one cannot always just reduce it to crime.
But there is, I think, as you get at in the book, there is oftentimes an assumption made, maybe even not understood consciously, that the racist assumption that crime equals, you'd say crime equals poor people, but then poor people have become collapsed into African-American people or people
right.
of color.
That's right.
So that
That's right.
it's sort of a short step to sort of a racist connection.
Or that you even collapse crime with cities. I mean, there's such a thing as rural crime. And so that's what I was trying to parse
yeah.
Listener's very good question. Is that, A, you can't collapse or confuse crime with city, nor can you always just collapse it with poor equals black. I mean, so when we say crime, what are we talking about?
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest again, Rich Benjamin, author of the new book, Searching for Whitetopia. If you want to call us, the lines are open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. The book is a fascinating and provocative look at race in America today, race and class, how people live, and how white people in particular are living in these new sort of almost entirely white enclaves budding all over the country. Let's go now to line one. Savoy, you're on the air with Rich Benjamin.
Hello. I was struck by the by your discussion that I did not hear, I think, the two most prominent facts about St. George, Utah. Number one, it being predominantly Mormon, and also the fact that it had such an extremely high rate of cancer deaths, being 100 miles downwind from Yucca Flats nuclear testing ground, and which affected the population. And in fact, I think there was a lawsuit filed against the government. And I don't know the outcome of that, but I'm surprised if you did not learn this from the local population there. Would you remark on this, please?
Thank you very much, caller. Rich Benjamin?
Yes, yes, yes. Remind me what – I'm going to address her second comment, but remind me her first comment.
About Mormonism.
About Mormons. Oh, yes, yes. One time I'm driving along, and then there's this line snaking outside the back of a strip mall. And I asked the person I was driving with, I said, what is that line? They said, oh, that's the line to the one liquor store in St. George County, and it was a Friday night, and that liquor store was about to close. So it snaked quite a long way. And the caller is right. St. George, Utah is 65% Mormon, so it's a majority Mormon. And I think, let's face it, Mormons are socially and culturally conservative. And so that fact is a positive to many of the people who go to St. George. They say, okay, because it's mostly Mormon, there's going to be some safety, there's going to be some comfort, there's going to be some order. And so I think that is a draw for St. George, the fact that it's so Mormon, even though there are a lot of tensions between Protestants and Mormons. And Protestants would pull me aside and they say, hey, Rich, Mormons run this place like a mafia. You know, try and start a business if you're not Mormon in St. George. And I'm just reporting what I hear. So, yes, the caller's right. And that's how Utah differs than, say, Georgia or the Whitetopias on the East Coast. The second fact she mentioned, I can't verify that as a factual matter the way she described it, but the general spirit of her point is right, that St. George and Washington County have a higher prevalence of cancer incidents because of what she described, the upwind of the testing facility in Nevada. But people don't talk about that, or at least the people I spoke to didn't talk to it about it to the degree that they spoke about immigration. And so I don't know whether there's a suppression going on, an amnesia, a denial, but that wasn't as hot a topic of debate as, say, taxes or immigration.
Let's go to another caller right now. Let's go to line two, Champagne. You're on the air with Rich Benjamin.
Yes. I've been very struck by the fact that although your book, I gather from its title and from the discussion, is oriented toward toward racial questions, and you are a black man going into communities that apparently are shaped, at least in part, by the desire of the people there to be among their own, one might say. And yet, you haven't said anything about, and the host hasn't thought to ask you about, the apparent ease with which you were able to become part of the social fabric, joining the country clubs and playing golf and even being in such informal groups as poker players and getting along fine. And I'm interested in what you have to say about all that.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Yeah, Rich, I thought we'd alluded to that earlier, but please develop that a little more, if you would.
Yeah, it's a fascinating conundrum in this country. I think that genuinely, and this is where I disagree from many liberals, I think that genuinely, in the last 40 years, we've made a tremendous progress on interpersonal race relations. And those relations that the caller just described are vastly better than when my parents were coming up. And so that's true. I mean, we live in a country where one educated black man can integrate himself very thoughtfully and intimately in these communities. The question then becomes, what if 10 non-white people do, or 10 non-white people who don't have my demographic profile? So what the book does is to say, yes, in these ways, race relations have gotten incredibly better in the last 40 years. And Barack Obama is also testament to that. But it's also to say we need not look at sort of the touchy-feely interpersonal part of it. It's not how any given person is treated or how any given person feels. It's what are the power dynamics, what are the structural relationships that keep this country as segregated today as it was in 1970, which was before I was born. So the book does make a distinction between interpersonal dynamics, how we treat each other as human beings, versus how does power shake out in this country.
In fact, Rich, I mean, during the course of the book, this becomes a major issue that you really take significant space to develop in the last half of the book, this difference between, or maybe to put it, the paradox of what the caller talked about, with the ease of which a person like yourself could and go to these communities and be welcome and treated with respect and warmly, and then the sort of fundamental numbing problem of extraordinary amounts of segregation still remaining in the United States and a race and class divide where the two are really fused together.
Exactly. I mean, I couldn't put it better. I mean, there's not more for me to say.
Well, maybe we should co-author your next book then.
Right.
Let's go back to the phone lines then. Line 4, Champaign County. You're on the air with Rich Benjamin, author of Searching for Whitetopia.
Pleased to be, too. The last caller, I guess, maybe missed the point that you said you didn't bring up politics. Now, you could say any number of things that would challenge this idea of white America. You could say that, well, you know, the White House was built by slaves. Indentured servants were regarded as lower class, too. Irish were not regarded as white for many years. You know, you have strike that up with an Irish guy in one of these Whitetopias and say, you know, and if you start challenging some of these, you know, unexamined ideas that they have about America that are, if you look at a little bit of history, a little bit of, dare I say, revisionist history, I mean, you could bring up the fact that Abraham Lincoln recognized Haiti after 50 or 60 years of isolation, most likely because he was hoping that maybe some of his African slaves that he fought supposedly so hard to free would leave the country and go to Haiti and repatriate somewhere else because he thought that they should be on they would be more freer on their own soil was kind of the European racialist idea of the time. And if you were to challenge them in any of those subject matters, I don't think they would have been as friendly. And so I'm wondering if you're going to go back to these places and maybe do a little bit of that and then write your next book. Bob, you could go along and play some golf, too. So.
Well, yeah, my game needs a lot of work. I haven't played for about 40 years.
Well, this probably would take a while. Thanks a lot. And could you react to some of that, please?
Okay, Rich?
I mean, it's an interesting question. If I debated people on their opinions, would I have had as many insights as I do, and would they have treated me differently? Perhaps. And by the way, there's more than race. I mean, there's taxes, there's health care, there's immigration. And to have confronted them on their opinions on those issues, I mean, the caller raises a very good question. But I am glad I didn't, all things being equal, because I am here to report, I am here to learn, I am here to listen. I am not here to have a debate while researching a book.
What was striking, Rich Benjamin, in reading your book, you did go into American electoral politics and how they've evolved and over the last few decades. It's clearly a subject you're quite knowledgeable about. And these areas are, relative to the rest of the country, extremely Republican. Mm-hmm. And is that a fair assessment? And these are sort of growth areas for Republican politics.
Yes, that's fair.
And so those that seemed to be one of the striking features. So if you were to talk politics in these places, you'd be talking, given your own views, from a minority position.
Absolutely. And these are not every Whitopia is Republican leaning, but the vast majority of them are. And you track that by seeing how they voted in both the 2000, the 2004, and the 2008 elections. And so, yes, they are overwhelmingly Republican-leaning. One example of liberal, quote-unquote, Democratic Whitopia is Boulder County, Colorado. Boulder County, Colorado went for Barack Obama by a margin of, like, 28 percentage points, and yet it's a Whitopia.
Our guest, Rich Benjamin, author of the new book, Searching for Whitopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America, just published by Hyperion Books. We've got Rich on for another 12 or 13 minutes. If you want to call in, the number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We have another caller waiting patiently. Let's go to line one, Urbana. You're on the air.
Yes. I'm sitting here listening and things. Wondering if I can believe all of this. First of all, there are still prejudices in this country. And white people has always, what you call it, white flight anytime a black come in. Now it's Mexicans, you know. And I'm wondering how you was able to mingle with the white people and things. And they talk to you about how they really felt and things. First of all, I would like to know, is your mom white, your daddy white, your mom black, your daddy, whatever? Are you mixed? And about your complexion, could you pass for a white man that's tan, little tan? Because that has a lot to do with it. The color that you are. If you was real dark, you wouldn't have never been able to get what you got in Utah. I'm 73 years old, and I go back a long ways. Ain't no way that you could tell me if you was real dark that you could have gotten in there and got all that information. I hang up and listen. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you very much for the call. And I know you've got a lot to say this. I just want to say, if you go Google Rich Benjamin, you will get the answer to the question very quickly. But yes. Rich, take it from there.
Yes, so you will see my picture, but more importantly, you'll see beautiful pictures of these Whitopian communities on my website, richbenjamin.com. I feel like the caller is asking me if I were light-skinned and had no Negro dialect, unless I wanted to have one, could I research this book? It sounds a bit like Harry Reid's comment. I guess I do have no Negro dialect unless I wanted to have one. But I should tell the caller, I am so dark, they called me Blueberry as a child. So I am dark-complected. And it just speaks, to my mind, to the changing nature of this country. She's a bit skeptical and surprised. But everything I say, everything I claim is well-documented in the book. And it's further documented by one Whitopian who I had met extensively posted these extensive comments about our encounter on Amazon. And so it's in fact true. And it's harder for people of an older generation to sort of believe what has happened. But indeed, it has happened. So, yeah, yeah.
But I mean, this. I think the point you get to in the book too is if you you've raised in an upper middle class suburb, you have a PhD. You read the book. You invoke literary references and historical references. You're extraordinarily well educated. That's a factor in all this. I mean, in your acceptance, I assume.
Yes, and that point is well taken. But my point was that it's more a function of class than skin complexion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we can't dismiss what the caller is saying entirely, because I also point out in the book, and this is why Harry Reid's comments are true.
No, for some listeners who might have missed those comments, you're referring to his comments about Obama.
Yeah, he encouraged Obama to run, and he told the president, hey, listen, you know, you're light-skinned and you don't speak like a Negro, therefore you're more likely to win. And so, but the sentiment of what the caller is saying is, indeed, when sociologists measure and track segregation, darker-skinned blacks are more likely to be segregated than lighter-skinned blacks. That is a fact. And so when we look at progress that we've made in integration, oftentimes that progress gets measured by skin complexion among both Latino and among black people. So light-skinned Latino people who especially do not have an accent are more likely to be integrated with whites than darker Latino people.
Let's go back to the phone lines for another caller waiting to speak with Rich Benjamin, who you've just been listening to. Rich Benjamin, the author, again, of Searching for Whitetopia. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hi. I was on your website for the book, and there's a picture of a woman that created, I think it was a Dixie Fiesta, and it talks about how she received death threats. I was just wondering if you felt maybe protected because you were a novelty, being the only one. And just because I'm not even as old as the other person, I'm also black and a little skeptical about how welcoming these communities that want to be around predominantly white people are. So if you could just comment on that. Thank you.
Rich?
Yes, he's referring to St. George, Utah, through its first Dixie Fiesta, and it was meant sort of as a token gesture to celebrate Latino heritage. And the woman who proposed it and the woman who was going to organize it received death threats on the phone from extremist elements in that community. And that's another thing that surprises me about this book, is that I have taken America's racial progress at face value, but a lot of left-of-center people seem skeptical at the claim that a black man can go to an overwhelmingly white community and be well-treated. And I don't understand quite why that's so surprising. Yes, I acknowledge that racial inequality exists, but I don't quite understand why it's so surprising that white people, even or especially wealthy white people, are so hostile.
You know, I think the third place, which we haven't spoken about yet, is really...
Do you understand, Bob?
Yeah.
Do you understand people's skepticism?
No, I absolutely understand it. I think the questions make a lot of sense. And I think, you know, your book is really revealing, because you go into such detail of your interactions with people. And that's why this third place, Rich Benjamin, Forsyth County, I think is the most interesting place in the book that you go to in a lot of ways, because of its racial history. Is this is basically, if you were to pick the worst county in America for American racial history, or one that embodied the things that Americans would be, I think, hopefully most ashamed of, it would be Forsyth County, Georgia. And this is a Whitetopia. So could talk a little bit about its racial history and then your experiences there.
Yes, yes, yes. Forsyth County, Georgia, is an hour north of Atlanta, Georgia, and part of the 1837 Trail of Tears, where Native Americans were violently expelled from North Georgia, took place in this county. That's one part of its racial history. Another part of its racial history was in 1912, a young white girl was raped and murdered. Black youth were accused. Some of them were lynched, and mobs emerged after that, after the trial and the violent incident, and they expelled black people from the county in a violent uproar.
And appropriated their property. Many of them were farmers.
Yes, yes, yes. Many of these black residents were longtime farmers. This was 1912. Some owned their farms. Some were sharecropping their farms. And they were just expelled at gunpoint. So all of the 20th century, from 1912, literally until the 1990s, you didn't have any black people in that county. And black folks in Atlanta, when I told them I was living in Forsyth County, they said, we don't stop in Forsyth County. We'll wait till we're in the next county to use the restroom. But again, I mean, it's documented in the book. It can be verified that my treatment there was, for the most part, quite pleasant. I mean, you have modern-day people who've moved into that community who aren't aware of its racial history. They're what they call transplants. And so Forsyth was quite interesting. Unlike Utah or Idaho, it was just charged with this past.
And, you know, we've only got a few minutes left, Rich Benjamin, and I'd like to talk. President Obama comes up in the book periodically, and I think it's sort of a framing for the changes, his presidency. What is your take on President Obama and his importance? And here I mean not simply in terms of race and our understanding of race, but more broadly politically in the country today. What's your assessment of him?
President Obama has a lot on his plate, and I think we're living in an extremely special point in history that's pregnant with both opportunity and peril. And I'm very much hoping that Obama can seize the right move on many fronts. And this is a future-looking book. I like to think it's an optimistic-looking book. What kind of country are we going to have 2042?
In that year, again, its importance for listeners who might have tuned in late.
2042 is going to be when white people are no longer the majority. But around that time, other interesting things will be happening, like Social Security potentially going insolvent. And so Obama has a lot of on his plate, and obviously governments alone do not solve our problems. I know that. Private citizens do, businesses do, and civic organizations do. But, you know, this book points out a lot of challenges, a lot of minefields that we have in this country. And the question is, what do we, most importantly, as Americans do, and what will the president do?
Rich Benjamin, but if you could, if President Obama and Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi and called you up and said, Rich, we read your book and we're really struck by it, and we want to implement policies which will go the furthest towards strengthening, eliminating racial barriers, structural racist barriers, and strengthening equality in this country. And we're looking for policies, tangible things. What sort of things would you tell them that you think would be of value?
Well, first and foremost, we're about to continue spending the $800 billion on our infrastructure. We're building roads, communities, bridges, broadband access. The question becomes, are we going to build and bolster our communities? Given fuel costs, elder care needs, and environmental decay, are we going to build a glut of suburban villages and cul-de-sacs and gated communities? Or are we going to build town square-style green communities with integrated schools, civic hubs, and pre-K centers? What kind of communities, literally, and policies are we going to imbue? Is Obama going to reform immigration? I think that would go a lot to sort of mitigating the racial and class inequality that comes with immigration. So there are a lot of concrete things in our immediate future that we're tackling.
Well, you know, Rich Benjamin, I want to thank you for taking an hour from your Sunday to talk with us today about your new book, Searching for Whitetopia. And I wish you the best of luck with it in the coming weeks and months.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for the interview.
It's my pleasure. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580. I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, for arranging the show, Kyle Kroha for working the board. We're going to be back 1 week from today with Janine Jackson of Fairness in Action Reporting. Please join us then. And until then, everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Here's the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana. There's a chance of rain this afternoon, with temperatures falling into the 30s. Tonight, cloudy and colder with a low of 29. Monday, cloudy with a 50% chance of snow, the high around 31 degrees. Monday night, cloudy and cold with a low around 18. This is Illinois Public Media WI.